Most of us are stubborn, just selfish to the core. We want our way, not someone else's, and certainly not God's. Short-sighted, we see the immediate and the obvious. We don't see the ultimate and the hidden. It's just the way we're put together. Easily irritated and impatient, our first reaction when taken advantage of, well, let's face it, it's to retaliate, to establish a defensive posture and not give anybody even an inch. Those efforts only intensify when faced with an adversary. Then we aren't satisfied with simply standing our ground and being determined. Getting even becomes our agenda. In his Sermon on the Mount, Jesus offered revolutionary, even strange advice for his people. Without pulling his punches, Jesus addressed the very best way to handle sensitive situations with those who threaten our personal rights. He offered countercultural counsel and dared us to obey. In place of retaliation, release. Instead of hate, love. Don't get even. Pray. It's with this counsel in Jesus' sermon that most people have their greatest struggles. And that is our message today. Simple advice to the selfish and strong-willed. In light of the significance of the message, I want you to listen very carefully as I read Matthew 5, verses 38 through 48 from the New Living Translation. Matthew 5, beginning with verse 38. You have heard the law that says the punishment must match the injury. An eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. But I say, do not resist an evil person. If someone slaps you on the right cheek, offer the other cheek also. If you are sued in court and your shirt is taken from you, give your coat too. If a soldier demands that you carry his gear for a mile, carry it 2 miles. Give to those who ask, and don't turn away from those who want to borrow. You have heard the law that says, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. In that way, you will be acting as true children of your Father in heaven. For he gives his sunlight to both the evil and the good, and he sends rain on the just and the unjust alike. If you love only those who love you, what reward is there for that? Even corrupt tax collectors do that much. If you are kind only to your friends, how are you different from anyone else? Even pagans do that. But you are to be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. Every generation has its slogans. Back when our nation was winning its independence in the 18th century, there, of course, came to be known the statement made by Patrick Henry, give me liberty or give me death. Perhaps it was sufficient to keep our nation at the task of winning its independence. One that I even preferred to that was trust in God, but keep your powder dry. That came from the fields of those who were fighting in the trenches for our right to exist as a nation. When I was just a boy, I remember the slogan that grew out of the Second World War, remember Pearl Harbor. Somehow that seemed to be enough patriotic zeal that it would keep us at that task back then in that great war that was fought in two theaters that sandwiched us in between. In my young adult years in the 1960s, another series of slogans came to be familiar to our ears. It was during that time that patriotic zeal waned and submissive allegiance gave way to snarling defiance.
Vietnam came to be known as the unwinnable war, and we hated the way that sounded, but it proved true. Slogans began to appear across our television screens and across the headlines of the media in various fashion, saying things like, if it feels good, do it, and let it all hang out. And by, this defiance worked its way into the apathy of the 70s as the Oval Office failed in its integrity. And some of us, for the first time in our lives, did question authority. A lot of things were up for grabs in the 70s. Capital punishment failed and faded out of the public's attention and interest, it seemed. Traditional values like the home and the school and the church and marriage and family began to be called into question. Our country wondered about nuclear energy and marched against it, and civil rights and human rights, especially human rights. Seemed as though we lost our grip on the absolutes in the 60s and the 70s. And the tide of apathy arose and caused our sandcastles of hope to be washed out to sea. Erosion took its toll. This created a different mentality in our society. We began to get accustomed to you deserve a break today, and we're ready when you are, and you owe it to yourself, and have it your way. We liked the sound of that. I remember when our family moved from a little country town in South Texas to the industrial city of Houston, which was then, if not the crime capital, one of the crime capitals of the world. I remember being afraid as a little boy in the fourth grade. My mother talked to a friend of ours by phone and picked up a saying that came to be true. She said, Lovell, you'll just have to get used to a dog-eat-dog world. I'd never heard that before. In a dog-eat-dog mentality, which was not limited to that city but is now a part of life, we began to live by other rules. I think of three or four of them. One says, I have my rights. And I began to get very defensive about my rights. Most people know their lawyer's name better than their pastor's name. If you cross me, I sue you. And for the slightest offense, it seems, people are being sued. Physicians now run a little scared before a radical or major surgery. It's enough to break them financially, and some have been. I've got my rights. I heard one yesterday that I'd forgotten was still a slogan of our day, do unto others before they do it unto you. A third one says, shoot first and ask questions later. And one of the more recent ones, I don't get mad, I get even. I get even. If we got permissive in the 60s and disillusioned in the 70s, we got greedy and defensive in the 80s. We're a hostile lot. We like chips on our shoulder. We like fights. That's the way it is when you're selfish and strong. I learned fighting in the streets that you need to hit first. The person who hits first has an advantage over the opponent. And that's flowed over into our lifestyle as adults. All this brings me to some of the most difficult words we could possibly read that were originally spoken from the lips of Jesus. In our volatile society, words like these in Matthew 5, 38 to 48 don't ring very well. In fact, we're not sure that they really mean what they say. So I need to help you before we go any further to just lay down your arms. Just unload your weapons. Leave them at the door. Understand that you have probably fallen victim, as many have, to an American theology rather than a biblical theology. There's a real difference. It is easy to catch our philosophy from the world around us and the nation we love more than from the book of God. And when that occurs, we tend to read into the text what we want it to say rather than draw from the scriptures what indeed they are teaching. Let's try not to do that. This is Jesus' countercultural counsel for those of us who live in the last part of the 20th century. He begins by quoting perhaps the oldest law in the history of civilization. "You have heard it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth." Now, most of you probably think he is drawing that strictly from its primary reference, which would be the Mosaic law. Indeed, Jesus is. But it is not the first time it has been heard by mankind. Moses wasn't the first to talk about that or write it, directed by God. It first occurred, to the surprise of many, in the Code of Hammurabi, who lived and ruled over Babylon 2285 to 2242 BC. To quote part of it, "If a man has caused the loss of an eye, his eye one shall cause to be lost. If he has shattered a limb, one shall shatter his limb. If he has made the tooth of a man fall out," I like the way that reads, "if he has made the tooth of a man fall out, one shall make his tooth fall out." When we get to the days of the Mosaic law, we read similar words. Allow me. Exodus 21. "But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise." Exodus 21, 23 to 25. And here, Leviticus 24. "If a man injures his neighbor just as he has done, it shall be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, just as he has injured a man, so it shall be inflicted on him." One more, Deuteronomy 19. "Thus you shall not show pity." Yes, those words appear in Deuteronomy 19, 21. "Thus you shall not show pity, life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot." So when Jesus says, "You have heard," indeed they had. Retribution in the first order. We in America have long since forgotten that. Capital punishment is no longer acknowledged by law in many places, though it is still the method of dealing with guilty murderers. God has never overwritten that or wiped it off the record. Jesus is talking, however, in verses 38 through 42, about releasing instead of resisting. Woven into these words are certain rights that we in human nature cling to. Now, you have to think with me for a while. This isn't entertaining instruction. You have to put your thinking cap on, as they used to say to us in school, and not let your mind wander. I think there's enough self-interest here for us to do that. However, it will take some detailed and in-depth thinking for you to track where I feel Jesus is coming from. I find in verses 39 through 42 four areas of rights that Jesus addresses. Number one, my right to dignity, to be treated without insult. He talks about that in verse 39. Verse 40, my right to comfort, to cling to what pleases me and makes me comfortable, warm in the winter and cool in the summer, my right to do that. That's verse 40. He talks about my right to privacy and my own personal schedule, to do what I prefer, when I prefer to do it, for as long as I prefer, my right to privacy. And fourth, verse 42, my right to possessions, to keep exclusive to myself the things I own. Let any of those rights be threatened today, and I can assure you somebody is going to be in court. Jesus doesn't offer that as his guideline. Now, let me clarify something before I go any further. And once again, think with me. At no place in this sermon does Jesus address the government of a nation. This is not something for our government to read and find its cue in or from. This is personal admonition for the Christian. This is not something for the courtroom to follow. Government's job is not the same as the Christian's job. The Christian is to follow the teachings of Jesus Christ as an individual. Government has a basic law of protecting its constituency, its people, serving it well. Jesus is speaking to people who are living their personal lives, and if they claim to follow him, he is telling them how to do that. This is to all Christians who claim to be followers of the way, to have Christ's will in their lives. Please do not make these principles for government. Number one, release your right to personal dignity. Now look at how he puts it. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist him who is evil, but whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. Please understand that in Jesus' day, there were words that could have been used for punching someone in the mouth and knocking him into the middle of next week. Jesus does not use those words. He uses terms specifically for a reason. A slap on the cheek is another way of referring to an insulting comment. A slap on the other cheek is another insulting comment. Especially true in the East when a back of the hand is a statement of insult. It isn't the same as a doubled up fist thrown into the mouth of another person. We still have the colloquialism in our day. It was a backhanded comment, we say, when someone has made an insulting remark. What a backhanded comment. It's the back of the hand to the cheek. Just as we did not take plucking out the eye and cutting off the hand in a wooden, literal sense, neither do we take the slap of the hand in a literal sense of slapping the cheek, but an insulting expression. You know, in our fight back mentality, we are good at reacting with insults. None was better than Winston Churchill, who had no love affair with Lady Astor. She found him with a group of people inebriated in a hotel elevator, and she said with disgust, "Sir Winston, you are drunk." To which he replied, "M'lady, you are ugly. And tomorrow, I will be sober." That's slapping back when you have been slapped on the cheek. He was a master at it, and the more you do it, the better you get at it, and some of us are very good at it. We can make one insult look mild compared to our retort, and Jesus says, don't. Give him the other cheek. May I press it further? In our driving, we are on the freeway and some clown comes on the freeway and cuts us off. just almost to the point of taking a little shade of our paint onto his fender, and cuts right in front of us. What do? You usually do not think, bless you. You usually wait for your space in the next lane so you can get up next to him and what? Cut him off, or pray that someone in a truck will cut him off before you get to him. That's just the way it is in human nature. An old Irish preacher who had been a boxer and a good one for years was converted. He happened to be in a new town setting up his evangelistic tent, and a couple or three thugs from the city noticed that he was there, knowing nothing of his background. They made a few snide remarks, and he turned and looked at them, and one of them took a swing and struck a glancing blow on one side of his face. He shook it off and stuck out his jaw, and the fellow took another glancing blow on the other side. The preacher took off his coat, rolled up his sleeves, and he said, "The Lord gave me no further instructions." What? Spurgeon said, "We are to be the anvil when bad men are the hammers. We are to take the blows of bad men's words. Let them glance off of you. But nowhere are we to be doormats to rapists." Or the victims of a murderer. I appreciate one man's very helpful summary. Christ's illustrations are not to be taken as the charter for any unscrupulous tyrant, beggar, or thug. His purpose was to forbid revenge, not to encourage injustice, dishonesty, or vice. True love takes action to deter evil and to promote good. He teaches not the irresponsibility which encourages evil, but the forbearance which renounces revenge. Some have taken this verse to ridiculous extremes and promoted an uncompromising pacifism. If they had their way, I'm sure the tyrants of the world would rule their land. Martin Luther describes one such individual as the crazy saint who let lice nibble at him and refused to kill any of them on account of this text, maintaining that he had to suffer and could not resist evil. If you have roaches, don't use verse 39 as a basis of letting them live on. If you have rats, poison those suckers. If you have lice, don't let them nibble away. Verse 39 has nothing to do with that. And if our nation has an enemy, there is nothing in verse 39 that says, sit back, let him conquer. The slap on the face is clearly an insulting comment. Release your right to answer back. And you know when you do, the fight is over. Many a home is in disarray because it simply hasn't followed the teachings of Jesus in verse 39 through verse 42. I'll say more about that in a moment. Second, release your right to cling to comforts. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. This isn't courtroom counsel, remember. This is personal counsel to the Christian. In this case, the man was rather well off, had both shirt and coat. Many lived with only shirt. The coat was a cloak worn around the body, much like a blanket. And at night, something like a temporary bed, sleeping blanket. Like our heavy terry cloth coats. When one would work, he would take off his cloak and would work in his tunic, sometimes referred to as being in a condition of nakedness because it was the same as his underwear, his shirt. But he says here, let him have your coat also. We live in an era where we have our rights to have any comfort we wish and let the rest of them eat cake. Jesus is saying, those aren't my words. This is a picture of one who needs to be moved with the needs of others and to release them without selfishness. I have a very unselfish brother, far more unselfish than I. For years, I have watched him live his life. He's now a missionary in Buenos Aires and has been there over 30 years. I watched him when he was a teenager in walking with God. I watched him when he was a young sailor and walked with God. My father was a very carefully minded clipboard kind of guy who took account of everything and taught us strict rules about life. Don't ever pick up a hitchhiker. Watch out for your own. Take care of your own needs. And you know, you had a dad like that, so you know what I'm talking about. My brother never did all of those things. So my father and my brother were in conflict. When my brother was out of the Navy and was driving back from the Great Lakes down to Texas, he came through Kansas and picked up a hitchhiker. He realized that it was a great moment for him to lead this man to Christ. He found out that he had been in prison, and he certainly had known nothing of the saving grace of God, and Orville led him to the Savior. When they reached northern Oklahoma, I believe it was, and it was a cold afternoon, the man said, "This is where I get out, and I can't tell you what you've done to help me." So as he stood out there and said goodbye, his collar was blowing up against his face, and it was a cold winter day, and my brother said to him, "Where is your coat?" He said, I don't have one, but that's no problem. I'm not far from here." "Wait a minute." So my brother digs down in his sea bag, and he pulls out a pea jacket. You guys that were in the Navy remember those big pea jackets with those collars. You wrap it around. It looked like you were a turtle. You got it around your face. And it would keep the wind off your face. He tossed it out the window. This fellow caught it, and he said, "I've never met anyone like you in my life." Well, when my brother got home, my dad had sea bag inspection with the clipboard, and four pair of shorts, six pair of socks, you know, two caps, three trousers. "Where's the pea jacket?" "Well, Dad, it isn't there." My brother always had a great grasp for the obvious. And "Where is it?" "Well," he said, "I gave it to a man." "Well, who was he?" "Well, I don't know, Dad. He's somewhere between Oklahoma and Kansas." "Well, do you know him?" "No, he's an ex-con." "How'd you meet him?" "Well, he was a hitchhiker and I picked him up." My dad looked into my brother's face, shook his head, and said, "Orville, I just don't understand you." And my brother responded, "Dad, I don't believe you ever will." When you give someone your coat, most others won't understand you. Most of us have a closet full of coats. They match our outfits. Some may have several overcoats. Most people I'm with have never given away their first coat, except to some no-name at Goodwill in a pile of coats that they place at some station. Have you ever known the thrill on a cold day of giving up your coat? Or not just a coat, we're not into coats here, we're into unselfishness. If anything that someone else could use a lot better than you, Christ says, why not? Release your rights to cling to comforts. Nothing wrong with having comforts, just don't cling to them. As I've said for years, there's nothing wrong with having nice things. Something's terribly wrong when nice things have us. Third, release your rights to your own private lifestyle, your own schedule. In Jesus' day, it wasn't uncommon for citizens to feel the flat side of the Roman spear on their shoulder and someone behind them saying, "Pick it up and carry it. Carry it for a mile." Jesus says, "Whoever shall force you to go 1 mile, go the second." Now, in those days, I am sure that there was some kind of saying or some kind of advice. Take it a mile if they require a mile, 5,280 feet, but don't go one more foot. Jesus says, that's where we get the expression, go the second mile. The same term, by the way, translated force, is rendered compel over in the Gospels, where Simon of Cyrene is compelled to carry the cross of Jesus. Isn't that interesting? Aren't you glad he picked it up? Jesus says, don't just go the distance, double it. Will you remember that Christ does not limit this to church life and Christian circles? Would you remember that it applies beautifully where you're employed, especially if you're in people business? That there's something more important than quitting time? That there's something more important than you're getting all of your lunch hour? There's something wonderfully Christian about someone who goes beyond what is expected just as a habit of life. I want to assure you that if you live a lifestyle like this, you won't need to wrestle around to find an audience of unbelievers. They will be so curious, they'll have to talk to you. Christ never ordered an evangelistic campaign. The crowd came to him. Not so much because he did miracles, but because he was himself miraculous. He lived miraculous. He not only carried a cross, he took it and never answered back, though they covered his body with their saliva. And aren't you glad he did? Release your right to a great deal of privacy. And give to him who asks of you, and don't turn away from him who wants to borrow from you. Release your right to exclusive ownership. You have something someone else can use? Well, why not share it? I never knew how many friends I had till I owned a pickup truck. The books I've lost in letting people borrow them could probably make up a small library, and I'm sure some of the books in my library have somebody else's name on it. Sure, you're going to get ripped off. Sure, people are going to take advantage of you. I never met a generous person yet who wasn't taken advantage of, but I've never met a generous person yet who was a pessimist or negative. Never yet. Every generous person I know, even those who have been grossly taken advantage of, are people with incredible optimism. Don't let the few ripoffs make you bitter. There will be some who need to borrow from you. Let them do it. Does this suggest indiscriminate kind of giving? I don't think so. Rabbis love to point out that loving kindness was one of the very few things to which the law appointed no limit at all. Isn't that a great thought? No limit to loving kindness. William Barclay writes, "Are we then to say Jesus urged upon men what can only be called indiscriminate giving? The answer cannot be given without qualification. It is clear that the effect of the giving on the receiver must be taken into account. Now hear this well. Giving must never be such as to encourage him in laziness or in shiftlessness, for such giving can only hurt. But at the same time, it must be remembered that many people who say that they will only give through official channels and who refuse to help personal cases are frequently merely producing an excuse for not giving at all, and are at times removing the personal element from giving altogether. Well, so much for releasing rather than resisting. Some of you look as though you have a bone to pick with someone. I'm just telling you what it says. That's my job. And what you do with it is yours. I'm just telling you that this is one convicted preacher right now. But that doesn't hinder me from telling the truth. I wish I were a model of every one of these things. You have heard it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. I will give you a $100 bill if you can find that commandment in the Bible. Obviously, I've checked. He said, you have heard that it was said. You have heard it. It's never been written. The Pharisees said it. It was a Pharisaical saying. Love your neighbor, hate your enemy. Well, those Pharisees knew better. They knew that Proverbs 25:21 was in the book. If your enemy is hungry, give him food to eat. If he is thirsty, give him water to drink. That's in the book. They knew that. And you and I know that. Similar statements in the Old Testament. None of those statements said, love your neighbor, but hate your enemy. Vengeance, by the way, is God's job, not man's job. Taking vengeance against someone is never our responsibility. That's why he says such strong things about revenge earlier in this sermon. It's a gross distortion of the law deduced by the scribes and Pharisees. Now look at what he says. But I say to you, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you. Before we go any further, please observe what he does not say. Love the way your enemies live. Love their methods. Love their brutality. None of that's there. We're talking about people, eternal souls. No neighbor was ever led to Christ out of hate. Neighbors are led to Christ because another neighbor who knows the Savior loves him too much to mistreat him or to treat him the same. This is the ability to see beyond. That's what love does. Love has X-ray vision. It goes beyond the words. It sees beyond the surface. And like Christ, it goes to the soul. And it sees the soul in great need of help. And compassion goes to work. As with Corrie ten Boom and the guards who mistreated and brutalized her sister. True love sees beyond the treatment that it receives. True love doesn't need agreement to proceed. True love goes on against all odds. That's why he says love them. In fact, look at verse 45. I'm intrigued by the way the construction is in this sentence. In order that you may be sons of your Father. Now, why doesn't he say, in order that you may be Christians, or in order that you may be followers of mine? Well, let me give you a little bit of linguistic help here. It helped me to find this out. Aramaic is the language Jesus spoke. I imagine Matthew was here at the time the sermon was given. So Matthew and other disciples remember the words, even the phrasing. Since Jesus spoke Aramaic, his words were more akin to Hebrew than the Greek that became the basis of the New Testament. Hebrew is not a language rich in adjectives. Instead of saying he is a peaceful man, the Hebrews would often say he is a son of peace. Instead of saying she is a kind woman, Hebrews would often say, she is a daughter of kindness. Here, notice what he says. In order that you may be sons of the Father, may I rephrase it? Father-like. I like that. Very seldom have we ever used the word father-like, but it's here. In order that people may observe that you're like your father, but your father, not on earth, not somewhere in Israel, but your father who is in heaven. And what does he do in heaven? He causes the sun to rise on the evil and the good. And he causes the rain to fall on the righteous and the unrighteous. I've never been in a rainstorm, driven down the street and said, there's a Christian, there's a Christian, and there's a Christian. Those three houses are getting rain. Or in the field of the farmer and saying, that farmer's obviously righteous because he's getting sun. But those farmers are not. That's why they live in the swamplands. Sun and rain fall on them all. Because why? Because God sees the heart. That's why Christ would minister so graciously to those who hated him. Father-like people . Why would you just send the sun to those who are in your family and the rain to those who go to your church or go to our church? Why do that? He says in 46, don't even the tax gatherers do the same? If you greet your brothers only, what do you do more than others? Don't the Gentiles do the same? The Gentiles are the dogs. I won't tell you what the tax gatherers were. Oof. There just wasn't a good synonym for them that you could say in public. Then how far do we take it? Atheists? Yes. Criminals? Yes. There would have never been a prison fellowship if a man hadn't seen beyond the bars and the hateful things those men and women had done. You would never open your heart and home to someone like that if you didn't get beyond their actions. How about Nazis? Listen to Dietrich Bonhoeffer in the days of the Nazis. This commandment that we should love our enemies and forego revenge will grow even more urgent in the holy struggle which lies before us. The Christians will be hounded from place to place, subjected to physical assault, maltreatment, and death of every kind. We are approaching an age of widespread persecution. Soon the time will come when we shall pray. It will be a prayer of earnest love for these very sons of perdition who stand around and gaze at us with eyes aflame with hatred and who have perhaps already raised their hands to kill us. Yes, the church which is really waiting for its Lord and which discerns the signs of the times of decision must fling itself with its utmost power and with the panoply of its holy life into this prayer of love. My, what maturity. Faced with the grim threat, the grim reality of the Nazis, Bonhoeffer had the audacity to give that kind of counsel based on Jesus' sermon. Don't you see how far we've come from that? Don't you see how we've all imbibed the lifestyle of the 80s and the 90s. Don't you see why unsaved people aren't really that drawn to Christians? There is so little difference. And if all of these other verses haven't been tough enough, he closes with, therefore, you are to be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. Oh. Give me a break. Now, our God has never given us a commandment that was unattainable. So I have to discount the thought that it can't happen. So there must be some kind of understanding that I'm missing, which causes me to probe. This is certainly not human. God says to me, don't be human. He says, be perfect. Don't operate from a human philosophy. Operate from a divine philosophy. Let me go further. Alfred Plummer comes to my mind. He says, to return evil for good is devilish. To return good for good is human. To return good for evil is divine. So this is a divine kind of command. I think he's saying, aim at perfection. But wait a minute. What is perfection? Perfect is from the word telos or teleios. And I think there's a television commercial these days that pulsates with telos, isn't there? I forget what it's connected to, but I always sit up thinking I'm going to get a little Greek lesson, but they lay some trip on me and it's never Greek. So I go back. The basic meaning of telos is not an abstract philosophical kind of perfection. Behind the Greek word is functional perfection, to reach full purpose for which something is made. If I'm working on my boat and I need to get into the engine and I need a wrench that will fit a certain kind of a nut and I don't have one, I go to the hardware store and I buy it. I come back and I reach into the engine and I fit it into place. That wrench has become telos. It has fulfilled the purpose for which it was made. It assists in completing the task. The Christian has been made to be like God, Father-like. Romans 8 tells us that we are to be conformed to the image of Christ. This is the way Christ would have lived, and he's saying this in verse 48, do it as I would have done it. Make that your aim. Press for it. How may it be applied? Most of us have three major realms in which we live in relationships. An immediate realm of family, a broader realm of friends, and a broadest realm which would include enemies. Let me apply three circles, if I may. For the family, I have three words of advice. Release your rights. See the way we have been reading through this passage? You have heard, but I say. You have heard, but I say. Release your rights. There isn't a family conflict that can't be settled by releasing rights. I've never met a marriage that is too impossible if both sides equally were willing to release all rights. I know it has to be negotiated. I know there are rights and wrongs. I'm not ignoring that. I'm saying both with the attitude, I will release my rights. I will trust my God to pull us back together. Both parties saying the same thing. Usually one spars with the other and says, how dare you and how could you? And before long, we're back to the slaps on the face, followed by slaps on the face. Release your rights. Second, with your friends, look beyond the wrongs. There's something about a friendship that centers on the wrongs. It becomes no friendship at all. If you focus on the rights rather than looking beyond the wrongs, it'll really help. Every friend I have has let me down in one way or another, and I have let him or her down, but because there has been a willingness to overlook that, there's still a friendship. Love helps me stay at the task, and my friends as well. With your enemies, fulfill your role. There's good counsel. You be the wrench in their engine. You live it in such a way that it's a perfect fit for the things that they're missing in their lives. It is remarkable how the Lord will bring you together. Now, for the sake of a few idealistic souls who think, I can hardly wait to live like this. This is going to be fun. I just want to bring you back to reality. You will encounter misunderstanding and mistreatment. You will be taken advantage of. The only one who lived this perfectly was crucified. But it's still worth the cause. I left out a slogan on purpose because I wanted to leave it for the end, knowing of its emotional value in all our lives. Another slogan that arose in the 60s was, "We shall overcome. We shall overcome." And a lot of us didn't want to hear it because we are white. We resented that kind of defiance. It wasn't new. William Wilberforce had done it in England, attempting to free the slaves. You know what they did with Wilberforce? They slandered him and they spread all kind of false rumors about him. They said he was a cruel husband. He was not. A wife beater. Never. That he was married secretly to a black woman. Not true. Lincoln took up the torch in the middle of his rule as president and as a result became the object of hatred, not just in the South. The stories of the treatment he received from humans is beyond our comprehension. He died from an assassin bullet, yes, but a broken heart, even more. When Martin Luther King began to promote his vision of nonviolence, the South loaded up. He began to endure incredible injustice when suffering came his way. After his assassination, Dr. Benjamin Mays listed only a few of the things that he had endured. King's house had been bombed. He had lived day by day for 13 years under constant threats of death. Just imagine that. He was accused of being a communist. He was falsely accused of being insincere. He was stabbed by a member of his own race. He was jailed over 20 times, wrote most of his sermons from jail cells. He promoted love is the only force capable of transforming an enemy into a friend, and he died believing that. I'm not saying he or Lincoln or Wilberforce or any of us that pushes for something that is unpopular is anywhere near perfect. I'm just saying when you live by a cause that is so different it rebukes people, they may hate you for it. Nevertheless, let me exhort all of us to follow the teachings of Jesus Christ and to trust him to bring good, ultimately, from our living his way. Our Father, we pause at this moment to thank you for truth that never fails to reprove us in our unbelief, selfishness, and prejudice. Forgive us, our Father, for living so many years of our lives looking for ways to excuse our sin, fighting for our own rights and paying people well to help us do it. Show us another way, Lord. Start with me. Use these words, stinging though they are, as a catalyst to make us different, to help us to aim toward a perfection that marked Christ in reality. May we be often evil spoken of because of the good we live, rather than well spoken of though we are living in an evil way. I pray for Jesus' sake. Amen.
The preceding message, Simple Advice to the Selfish and Strong-Willed, was copyrighted in 1988, and the sound recording was copyrighted in 2014 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide.